Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moscowane. Jasmine Ward won the National Book Award for Fiction in 2011 for her novel Salvage the Bones, about a family in the days before Hurricane Katrina. Her new book, a memoir, is set in rural Mississippi. The Men We Reaped tells the story of Ward's childhood and coming of age, and the stories of five young men she lost in the short span of just 4 years. She's here to tell us more about that story. Jasmine Ward, welcome to Radio Times, and thank you for being here.
No, thank you for having me.
How did you decide to write this book?
I fought writing this book for a very long time. I didn't want to write about the events that I wrote about because, you know, it was too painful and I was too close to it. I wrote an essay that was sort of the seed for this book around 2005. And then, you know, it was suggested to me that I should think about maybe, you know, that it would be good material for a memoir then, but I couldn't do it. And so it wasn't until 2010, really, that I decided that that I could actually do this, like I could actually write this memoir, and that it needed to be written, you know. But, you know, as I was thinking about writing it, I spoke to my sisters specifically, because they lived so much of this, you know, with me, and I'm, you know, very close to them. And so I spoke to them and I asked them, you know, what do you think about this? You know, what do you think about me telling our story, you know, putting this down, you know, in a book, right, about us sort of losing our brother and losing our friends, and then also writing about, you know, our lives growing up. And they were both really enthusiastic about it, and both of them said, you should definitely do this. So
when did it come together in your head as one story? There were five deaths. You lost your brother, you lost a cousin, you lost three friends mm-hmm. in a short time. And when did it come together in your head as one story?
It was clear to me in 2005 that it was one story. You know, when I wrote that essay that was basically the seed of the memoir, I thought of the story as, you know, the last young man dies and the next young man dies, and then I conceived it as me sort of walking backwards in time and ending with my brother's death, and then using my family's sort of history as context to try to understand why an epidemic like that would happen. And it came to me like that. It wasn't something that I had to sort of work at and figure out. It was very intuitive.
Mm-hmm. And the memoir is not very much about you. It is about you, but mm-hmm. it's about bigger things.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I know that most people, when they think of memoir, they don't think that that would be the case, right? But it definitely is about, I mean, it is about me, but it is about bigger things. Because, you know, the question that I was asking myself is, you know, why would an epidemic like this, right, of young black men dying, right, why would that happen in the kind of place that I'm from, right, which is rural, southern? And it's the kind of place where that you just don't associate with epidemics like that. So that was the question that I was asking, and I realized pretty soon that in order to answer that question, that the memoir, you know, it couldn't just be about me. You know, it had to address like larger issues and larger concerns.
Because at times I found myself looking for you in the pages, especially once you went off to college, mm-hmm. and the story stays in your home community, mm-hmm. and we really don't know much about what's happening with you.
Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, I thought about that, you know, while I was writing it. I thought, man, you know, maybe this is too much of a leap, you know, because I'm not talking, you know, there aren't many places in there where I specifically talk about maybe like how I came to writing, or how I came to, you know, to, or how I did, how, what college was like for me, or, you know, just how, what led me to where I am now. But I think that part of the reason I did that is because I was afraid that I would lose focus, you know, if I had more of myself and of that part of myself in the memoir. So I didn't.
Describe the community where you grew up, where most of this book is set and stays.
Mm-hmm. So I grew up in DeLille. The part of the DeLille that I'm from and that I stay in is mostly black, right? Mostly poor and working class. It's a really small rural community. I need to look up the most recent census information for the town, but it's very, very small, like probably under 1,000 people.
In Mississippi.
Yeah, in Mississippi. I'm sorry. Yeah, in Mississippi. And you know, most of the people that live there have lived there for, you know, their families have lived there for generations, right? So on both sides of my family, like my mother's side and my father's side, they can think back to, like, you know, they're like great grandparents and then all the generations that came after that have, you know, that have been there. I mean, we're not clear on where they were before they came there, but we've all been there for, you know, our families have been there for a really long time. So there's this real sense of community because everyone knows everyone. I'm related to a lot. I have tons of cousins, you know, just on my mother's part, half of my mother's side of the family. I have over 200 cousins, you know, over 200 relatives. And that's just one part of my, you know, family. That's not even the whole thing. So,
and you describe there is a lot of happiness in the book, especially in your childhood. You describe, as you say, a very tight-knit community. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of love and a lot of freedom for the kids, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, I think it's, I mean, if someone, you know, I begin talking about the place where I'm from, and I think it surprises people sometime, you know, that there's happiness there, you know, and that, you know, even though we were poor, and things were hard, you know, that there are, you know, positive things about being where I'm from, and that, you know, there are things about that experience that, that I feel like, you know, make it worth, you know, sort of raising kids there and living there. Because I think that you can't, you know, that's something, you know, that experience of community, that experience of family, of a, not just a nuclear family, but a very large extended family, that I think that's special, and that, you know, and that you don't get that often.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with author Jesmyn Ward. She has a new book. It's called The Men We Reaped. It is she is an American novelist. She won the 2011 National Book Award for Fiction for her previous book, which is called Salvage the Bones. And this is a very personal story about Jesmyn's life, but also about the lives of five young men that she lost over a very short period of time, 4 years. One of them was your brother, one was a cousin, and then there were three friends. If you want to join the conversation, if you have a question for Jesmyn, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. To go back to your community, there is a lot of connection, a lot of love, but there's also oppressive poverty, a lot of racism. How did you experience that as a child?
You know, as a child, you know, I write about it in the book. You know, as far as poverty, like, you know, there's a scene that I write about in the book where, you know, where we'd get up on Saturday mornings, and, you know, this is back in the 80s, so on Saturday, you know, in America, so on Saturday mornings, that's basically the only day that you're able to watch cartoons. And we had, I think...
Those were the days.
I think we only had, like, you know, something crazy like, you know, 5 channels on our TV, if that, right? And so, you know, we'd wake up at like, 6 a.m. on Saturday morning, and we'd go in and...
You and your siblings.
Yeah, me and my siblings and my cousins, right? Because there were so many, there were like 13 of us that lived in my grandma's house. And so, yeah, so all the grown-ups would be asleep, and we'd wake up and we'd go into the living room.
And this is a small house.
Yeah, it's a small house. It's like a 4-bedroom house. And so we'd go into the living room and we'd turn on the TV, and then we'd watch cartoons the whole, you know, during the morning before the adults would get up. And then we'd need breakfast, right? And so because all the adults were asleep, that I would have to make us breakfast. And so breakfast was cornflakes and then, you know, like cups and cups of sugar that we would dump over the cornflakes, and then powdered milk, right? because there were so many of us, like we couldn't afford to have like liquid milk, so we'd have powdered milk. And so I knew that it was part of my job to like go in, make us all bowls of cereal, dump sugar on them, and then mix up the powdered milk. And I remember being frustrated when I was that age, because I wanted the powdered milk. I remembered when we used to have real milk, right? When my dad had a job, when we didn't live in my grandmother's house, you know, and I remember being angry that the powdered milk was powdered, and that it didn't taste like real milk. And so I would like mix sugar and different things in it, try to make it taste like real milk, but it never did. And so that I think, you know, in a dim way, like I understood that, you know, that we were poor then, and we hadn't been, you know, before, right? That, you know, that there was a struggle, right? And so I understood that in very specific ways. Like, mm-hmm. I understood that in relation to the milk. I understood that in relation to, like, when we, on those Saturday mornings when we would watch cartoons, they show the Popeyes cartoons, right? And so Popeyes Chicken, like the fast food restaurant, they would sort of sponsor the mm-hmm. show, the cartoon. And so they would have, I guess they had a studio audience somewhere in New Orleans, but the studio audience always consisted of, they were always white kids. And I noticed that even when I was, you know, 7, 6 years old and we were watching, and I would notice that the whole audience would always be white kids. There was never a black kid or a kid of mm-hmm. color in the audience. And I remember being very jealous, and partly because I was so hungry, you know, and so dissatisfied with the powdered milk. And I remember being very jealous that we would sit there on the floor and we'd watch Popeyes and watch these kids on the screen and watch them eating their, you know, 2-piece, you know, chicken sandwiches. I mean, the chicken with their biscuits, and be very jealous that they had, and it sounds very sorry, but that they had, like, you know, warm, good food, and that we were eating, you know, cornflakes with powdered milk.
Is the community itself very segregated? Because you describe in the book also a long intermingling mm-hmm. of the races, but that nobody speaks about.
There is that. You know, there is, as you said, there is a long intermingling of the races, but it's correct that no one really sort of speaks about it. So mostly the community is very segregated. You know, I mean, I feel like in recent years is a little less. So specifically I'm thinking about the Catholic churches that serve the area. My mm-hmm. family's Catholic. So the Catholic churches that serve the area, before they were much more segregated. You know, there was the black Catholic church, and then there were two other white Catholic churches, but now they've combined them together. You know, mm-hmm. so I think that in recent years, there's this move to sort of make at least like the social aspects of the community less segregated. But I think partly because you know, where I'm from, like, nobody acknowledges that there's this mixing of races within families, and social events tend to cluster around families, so therefore things remain segregated.
Mm. How about your elementary school?
My elementary school, my elementary school was fairly, well, it was, I mean, there was a good mix of students, you know. I mean, there were a lot, of course, there's a large black population there.
Oh, sorry, we do have to take a break, okay. But we will get back to that in a moment. That's Jesmyn Ward, and she is joining us today to talk about her book, The Men We Reaped. If you have a question for Jesmyn, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back here on Radio Times after a short break, and we'll get back to your elementary school then. Thank you, and stay tuned to Radio Times. We'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by Trader Joe's, offering apple blossoms, individual pastries filled with sweet-cooked Northern Spy apples and topped with cinnamon crumble. Store locations are at TraderJoe's.com.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase offers lung screening for individuals at high risk of lung cancer, based on results of a national trial which showed death from lung cancer was reduced by 20% with early detection. Qualified candidates receive a low-dose CT scan and an appointment with an advanced practice clinician to discuss the results that same day. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, your first choice in cancer care.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, Afghanistan is getting ready for a presidential election, and whoever wins will oversee the final phase of the U.S. troop withdrawal. Are Afghans ready to take control in the battle against the Taliban? We'll talk with NPR's Kabul correspondent, Sean Carberry. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. supporting WHYY North Highland Worldwide Consulting for over 20 years, helping clients around the world solve complex business problems by listening before talking. Online at northhighland.com/you first.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking with Jesmyn Ward. She has a new book called The Men We Reaped. Her previous book won the National Book Award for Fiction. It was called Salvage the Bones, and she's here to talk about her new book, which talks about her life, but also the lives of five men very close to her that died over a very short period of time. Jesmyn, we were just talking about the community that you grew up in, which was poor, but also had a very loving kind of community and very vibrant family connections, and you knew everybody. What were your parents like?
Let's see. My parents. So my dad, he was a, you know, he's a bit of a free spirit. His dream was always to have a kung fu school, because he's been practicing kung fu since he was in his late teens, you know. You don't encounter many people like him, you know, either outside of the South and especially in the South, right? So he's, you know, he has a great sense of humor. He's very charming. He's very handsome, and he's a kung fu master. So it's very, you know, it's a very sort of unique, odd, you know, combination. My mom, she's quieter than my dad. You know, she's much more reserved than my dad is. She's really private. She's always been, you know, a very hard worker, you know, and she had to, because, you know, my dad left when we were, you know, she and my dad were married, and then they divorced, and my dad left when we were young, around when we were like eight, when I was like around eight or nine. And then she had to raise four kids on her own. She was in her late 20s. She had to work very hard, you know, mm-hmm. and she had to, you know, to provide for us, when she probably, you know, doubted that she could, but she did. She pulled it together and she did it. But she's much, her sense of humor is much quieter than my father's, mm-hmm. you know, and I think because she is sort of, you know, more reserved, but,
And your parents continued to try to work at their relationship. Mm-hmm. There were always times when he had relationships mm-hmm. with other women. Mm-hmm. There were times when he was gone and then he would come back. Mm-hmm. Were you very aware? You were aware. You describe a scene where you're sitting outside with mm-hmm. your brother and your parents are just screaming mm-hmm. at each other.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think that we knew sort of specifically, you know, what the issues were in their relationship, right? So we didn't know that my dad was straying, you know, that he was having relationships with other women. And that's why they were fighting. We just knew that they were fighting. I think, you know, like all children, that we wanted our family, right? We wanted our parents to be together. So it was difficult when we realized that he wouldn't be coming back, right? Mm-hmm. When they decided that was it, you know, that they were done. And I think that part of the reason that it was so difficult for us is because, you know, as I said earlier, like he was much more, you know, it was easy for him to be, you know, to be very affectionate and, you know, make these sort of big sort of affectionate gestures, because he didn't have the kind of pressures that my mom mm-hmm. had.
He swooped in
and then he was, you know, back out. So it was easy for him to do that, whereas it wasn't easy for my mom. So I think that's another reason why it was so hard for us when we were younger to really, you know, see how that dynamic was playing, or understand that that was even a dynamic, right? I mean, all we knew was that, you know, our father that was so funny and, you know, and fun was leaving again.
And how do you, in which ways was he affected by the world you guys lived in a very kind of oppressive, poor and racist environment?
And see, I think that's why he felt like, you know, like he had to leave over and over again, because, you know, my take on it is that he was denied, you know, denied a certain sense of like manhood and masculinity and promise, you know, and sort of belief in better things, right, by the world around him, you know, that sort of pinioned him and you know, and limited his options, right, limited his freedoms, right? He couldn't have a school. He could only work these, you know, sort of menial jobs, which, you know, when he was working these menial jobs, he could barely provide for his family. Then at the same time, he also had to deal with, you know, racism, you know, outside of his family. So everywhere he turned, he was denied any sort of like any, you know, assertion of his, of, you know, any assertion of his humanity, right, of being an individual. So my opinion on it is that so then he turns these frustrations towards his personal life and towards his family life, right? Mm-hmm. And so then he resents us or resented his family, right? Because, you know, because he could, I mean, he could resent the larger world, but there wasn't much that he could do to the larger world because, you know, that's the culture. So I felt like he turned that inward. And then
do you ever feel, I didn't sense this in the book, but mm-hmm. I was getting mad reading it. I was getting mad on behalf of your mom. Mm-hmm. I was getting mad at your
yeah.
dad.
No, I've definitely been angry with him. I mean, it was a struggle while I was writing the book to, because I didn't, I mean, I love my dad, you know, and I didn't want to, but I love my dad, but as an adult, now when I look back on, you know, his relationship with my mom, and when I look back and think about the fact, you know, that he left us, and think about how he left us and why he left us, like, you know, that's, it makes me angry, you know, and it makes me angry for her. And when I wrote the book, I didn't want to deny him his humanity yet again, right, and make him into a villain, right? So it was hard for me while I was writing the book, but I had to constantly remind myself that I wanted to make him as complex and as human as I could on the page. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I was trying to do, even though part of me was really angry, you know, as I'm like reliving, you know, him leaving yet again and sort of making the decision that, you know, this family that he made, that he wasn't going to take care, you know, mm-hmm. of it.
Yeah. And he created other families.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. I want to get to the men. Mm-hmm. who you speak about in the book, and that is hard. I almost feel like I haven't wanted to go there yet mm-hmm. because it is difficult. How mm-hmm. how was that for you to revisit? You describe each person in a separate chapter mm-hmm. and you kind of create a profile picture of who they were mm-hmm. and how they lived and how they died. Mm-hmm. How could you revisit those places?
You know, it was very difficult. You know, because not only did I have to relive those events, but, you know, I feel like one of the things that memoir, that it requires of you, is that it requires you as the writer to sit in the present moment, right, and look back on the past moment and offer some kind of judgment on the past moment, or try to, you know, sort of, you know, you have to like imbue that past moment with some meaning, right? And so that was difficult too, right? Because, you know, I had to revisit the past on multiple levels. So it was really hard. And this book, you know, this book was the hardest one. This book is the hardest thing that I've ever written. And that's part of the reason why. I mean, this book took longer for me to revise than any of the other mm-hmm. books that I've ever written, because I had to go back again and again and again and again, in order to attempt to get it right, because it was so difficult for me to go back in that past moment.
And you talked to the people who were there, you talked to the family, so you did a lot of interviewing too.
Yes, yes.
Let's talk about Raj. Mm-hmm. He is the first man mm-hmm. in the book who you profile. Mm-hmm. Who was he?
Raj had a great sense of humor. He was really funny. He had the physical characteristic that most people remember about him, like when you ask about him, is his smile, because he had such a big smile. And he, you know, he was a great joker. He liked to have a good time. He was, you know, but I think that, you know, on the surface, it just seemed like, oh, he was just interested in having fun, right? But then, you know, and he was really social. But then I think that you know, that the surface, of course, hid these depths where he was really kind and he was really gentle. And I think that if you knew him, and he's this big joker in life, that you wouldn't necessarily think that he had that kindness and that gentleness in him, but he definitely did.
And he went to Los Angeles for a while. Mm-hmm. He loved it there, but then he came back and you think, why did you come back?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a question that I ask in the book, but then I think about my own experience, right, of leaving and then coming back. And then there are other people in my community that I've talked to before. And, you know, I remember this one woman telling me, you know, you leave and you go away, but you always come back. And because she had left and then and she came back. And so, yes, I did think about that in relation to him. Like, why would he come back? And so, you know, I think that, you know, I use my own experience to sort of, I extrapolated that to sort of figure out, you know, why would he have come back? And I think it's partly the place, partly that sense of community, and partly, you know, your family that keeps bringing you back, you know, because these are the people that you know and that you love. And and I think there's something to be said about feeling a sense of belonging in a place. And I think that's one of the reasons that he did come back.
Mm. Now, he got into drugs. Did were you aware of that? How bad it had gotten?
In the very beginning, I wasn't very aware of it. But then towards the end, you know, closer to his death, then I became more aware of the fact that he had a problem with addiction. It's something that he fought, of course, and that he hid. You know, it wasn't something that he, you know, that he was like proud of. There wasn't, I mean, you know, I knew him because we would go over and we'd hang out at his house a lot, right? And so there was, and when we would go, we would drink, and you know, it was something of a party scene, but it wasn't the kind of party scene where he was openly doing drugs. That wasn't the case.
Mm-hmm. And is this the kind of thing where somebody would have said, hey, do you want to get help? Or are you, you know, was this talked about, or was it kind of kept hush hush?
I think that it was kept hush hush. I don't think that it was something that was really talked about. I think that maybe people in his family might have asked him about it. I don't know. That's not a question that I asked when I was, you know, doing the research for the book. You know, I do know that they were concerned about him, but he was an adult, and I don't know how much influence that they, you know, had on him to persuade him.
I wanted to ask you to read a passage from your book. Mm-hmm. It is a scene where you go to Raj's funeral, mm-hmm. and you at this point had also lost your brother.
Mm-hmm.
So read that for us, or set the scene first.
Okay. This is after Raj's funeral. This sort of happened at his house, or in the yard around his house, sort of on the after his funeral, where, you know, of course everyone gathered, and we were all, you know, giving our condolences to his family. After Raj's funeral, I tapped Rhea's shoulder. I opened my arms, hugged her. Her big, expressive eyes were bloodshot and wandering. I wondered what I would have wanted someone, anyone, to say to me when my brother died. Anything beyond, are you all right, and are you okay? I knew the answers to those questions. I whispered into her ear, he will always be your brother, and you will always be his sister. What I meant to say was this, you will always love him. He will always love you. Even though he is not here, he was here, and no one can change that. No one can take that away from you. If energy is neither created nor destroyed, and if your brother was here with his humor, his kindness, his hopes, doesn't this mean that what he was still exists somewhere, even if it's not here, doesn't it? Because in order to get out of bed this morning, this is what I had to believe about my brother, Rhea. But I didn't know how to say that.
Hmm. So what did you say to her?
I said, he will always be your brother and you will always be his sister. I couldn't put the rest of it into words. I wanted to, but at that moment, I couldn't, because I distinctly remembered, you know, in that moment, you know, that sense of bewilderment and just, and loss and, you know, and just, and how raw you are in that moment. And I think that at that it overwhelmed me, and so I couldn't say what I wanted to say to her.
And with your brother, was the first in that series of deaths. And with each following death, did that just rip open that wound again?
Yep, every time. And of course, that's what made in part like what made it so hard to, you know, to live through them again and again. Because every time, you know, one of my friends would die, or say my cousin CJ died, I would remember again. You know, it would be like, it would feel like my brother just died yesterday, and I just learned that he was gone again, and that he wasn't coming back. And it's awful. I mean, it's not until something, a loss like that happens, that you realize how wrong death feels. Even though birth and death are the most natural things in human life, but yet every time it happens, it feels so wrong, like fundamentally wrong. And of course, you know, that's what I experienced every time.
And talk about the connection. Is there a certain way that you could relate to somebody like the young woman you described there, that people can't understand how it feels until they too are there?
Definitely. And I think that was part of what I wanted to communicate to her in that moment, but then couldn't, because I was so the sense of the pain that I felt made me so inarticulate. You know, I just, you know, I hate to say it, but it's true. I mean, you can understand, you know, because you're a human being, you know, as a human being, because you've experienced loss, but really until you've lost someone that is that, you know, that close to you, like in your immediate family, you don't, it is hard to understand, I think.
And how old was your friend Raj?
He, of course, I don't have. Okay, 23.
Sorry,
yes.
I just did the math.
Okay, thank you.
I'm glad I covered that part of the
I'm
book.
So bad at.
And he was part of your growing up. He had a crush on your sister. He was a part of your kind of crew. Yeah. Is it like a part of your childhood goes with him?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, with each of them. You know, some more than others, because I was closer to some of them than others. Like, I think out of the young men, like beyond my brother, I think that I would probably have been the closest to CJ, you know, and partly because, you know, he was my cousin, and I saw him everywhere, and really, really, you know, grew up with him because he was in the family. So,
and briefly, we do have a break in about a minute, but what do you wish Raj would have had? What do you think could have helped him to maybe stay in LA? What is it? What is there a hole that was filled by the drugs, or?
You know, I just think that maybe he needed some sense of hope, you know, and some sense of possibility, and maybe a belief, you know, that he could make a worthwhile life in Los Angeles, perhaps, and maybe that's what he was sort of self-medicating against, right? This sense of hopelessness, which I feel like I saw in all of the young men, you know, when I was writing about them in some way.
We'll talk more in a moment. That's Jesmyn Ward. Her new memoir is called Men We Reaped, and it is about her story and her childhood, her growing up, but also about the lives of five young men she lost. We'll talk more in a moment. If you have a question, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back here on Radio Times.
Bristol Riverside Theater supports WHYY and presents Steve Solomon's all-new My Mother's Italian, My Father's Jewish, and I'm Still in Therapy, starring Steve Solomon, September 17th through October 6th. This show goes back with Steve from his baby years with his twin sister, right up to the present, with Uncle Willie, stuttering cousin Bob, demented cousin Kenny, and Steve's new therapist, just to name a few. 215-785-0100 or brtstage.org.
Being pro-gun control can cost you your job in Colorado. One recalled lawmaker says the political climate is a killer.
12 families in the Washington, D.C. area are going to be going to funerals. Their right to live has been extinguished.
Colorado's John Morris on why the D.C. shooting may not change anything. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Aspiring nonprofit leaders can get both the skills and credentials they need for advancement by earning a certificate from the Nonprofit Center at LaSalle University's School of Business. Certificate programs can be completed in 8 months and include nonprofit management, fundraising, finance, marketing and communications, or a build-your-own certificate. Course descriptions, packages, and schedules are available at 215-951-1701 or online at LaSalleNonprofitCenter.org. The Nonprofit Center supports WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking with writer Jesmyn Ward. Her new book, a memoir, is called Men We Reaped, and it describes Jesmyn's growing up in rural Mississippi, her childhood, her coming of age, so to speak, and also the lives of five men, among them her brother and a cousin and three friends who all died over the course of a short span of years. Jesmyn, when did you become a writer? When did you start writing?
I wrote for the first time when I was in sixth grade. I wrote a really bad poem for Arbor Day. So that's when I began writing. But then, you know, I wrote really bad poetry throughout high school and into college. And then while I was in college, I attempted to write more short stories. I took a couple creative writing classes, but I didn't take many because I thought that I was, you know, that I was no good at it and probably didn't deserve to be at the school that I was at.
Who mentored your talents?
So I worked with a poet at Stanford. That's where I was at for undergrad. Her name is Amy Kwan Berry, and she was really important to my development as a writer because she was the first writer, right, who I knew personally, who read my work and who said that she thought that I had some talent and that it was something that I should pursue. Now, part of the reason that she told me that is because I came to her and explicitly asked her whether or not I should give up. You know, I said, should I give up? Should I just stop? Like, maybe I just don't have it. And I'd rather someone, you know, tell me now that I don't have it than, you know, for me to spend years trying to do this.
You describe, with all the men you profile in the book, you describe this, the impact of the hopelessness on their surroundings, on their psyche. But that also affected you.
Yeah, definitely.
And how you felt about yourself.
I feel it wasn't until I began writing the book, and then, of course, going through all the revisions that I realized that part of what I had to do was I had to figure out, you know, why when I was growing up, like, even though, you know, I made pretty good grades while I was in school, I was accepted to a lot of the colleges that I applied to. I went to Stanford. I got a great scholarship. You know, so even though I was succeeding, right, in all these ways, at least on the surface, inside, I really felt very deficient, you know, and I felt like, I loathed myself. And so I did. It was awful. I loathed myself for years and years and years, and like even through college. And so I had to figure out what caused that, you know? And that's part of what I had to do when I went back and revised, you know? And so I just sort of figured out that part of the reason that I felt that way, right, even though I was doing these things that were supposedly that seemed so great, was because I was sort of repeating what the larger world was telling me about myself, you know, because I did have to deal with, you know, a disgusting amount of racism, you know, when I was growing up from like 13 on, right, with people constantly, you know, some of the kids that I went to school with telling me every day, you know, like, you're less, you know, you're less than us, you're barely even human, you know, and so I was hearing that story over and over again from them, and then I feel like I heard it, you know, in other ways, in other larger ways, just by, you know, sort of looking at, like, the circumstances of my life and of my family's life, where it seems like our lives were always valued less than the lives of those around us.
But did you talk about that? Did your mom ask you about your experiences at school? Did you talk to your friends about it?
I talked to some of my friends about it, but I think it was harder for them to understand. Well, some of my friends from home from DeLille mm-hmm. about it. But I think it was harder for them to understand it because, you know, the school that I was in and the situation that I was in was very specific mm-hmm. to me because them, you know, most of them went to either other private schools or public schools where there was a more equal number of black and white students, where there was more diverse. And so they weren't bombarded with those kinds of messages in the same way that I was.
Were you the only black student?
I was the only black girl for a very long amount mm-hmm. of time. And there was usually at least one or two young black men at the school, but I was the only black girl for a long time. And I was always, until, say, like my very last year in the school, I was always separated from those other students by a good amount of years. You know, either they were, you know, say 4 or 5 years younger than me or 4 or 5 years older than me. So mm-hmm. I was alone.
I want to talk about your brother.
Mm-hmm.
And you put his chapter, so to speak, is last, mm-hmm. even though he was the first mm-hmm. to go.
Mm-hmm.
But he was with you. He was almost a part of you
mm-hmm.
in your childhood. You were mm-hmm. so close.
Yeah, we were. I mean, you know, that's one of the reasons why I really wanted to write the book is because I felt like, you know, we'd grown up so close and, you know, and I knew all of these stories, you know, about him that my sisters didn't necessarily know, you know, and that even my parents didn't necessarily know, you know, because they were the parents and we were the kids.
He was the second boy.
Yes, he was the second boy. And I'm the oldest, and so we're separated by around two years and a few months, right? Almost 3 years. So, so we were really close. And he was my best friend when we were growing up. You know, we were together all the time. We, you know, got into all kinds of scrapes together. And, you know, we learned the same lessons together.
And as you soared or succeeded, even though you had all the struggles, but mm-hmm. still on many levels mm-hmm. you were really succeeding, mm-hmm. he was not. What was happening with him?
You know, I think he was learning different lessons about his place in the world, right? And about what others thought his place in the world should be, you know, than I was learning. You know, I mean, because I think there is a difference between being, you know, a poor black, you know, young woman in the South and versus being a poor black young man, you know, in the American South. And I think that, you know, that it was harder for him really to come to terms with, you know, how people saw him and what they expected of him and how those sort of, I guess, outside pressures, like how those narrowed his choices.
Mm-hmm. What could you have seen him do? What was he good at? What, in an ideal world, what would your brother be now?
You know, I don't know. I think about that all the time. I wonder, you know, he liked working with his hands, you know, so I mean, I could see him, you know, as a mechanic. I could see him, you know, maybe working offshore. I could see him maybe, you know, there are a lot of shipyards where we're from. So maybe working in welding or working, you know, in that kind, like in a trade. And that's what I think that he probably mm. would have done.
And how do you think, it seems like your father treated your brother differently, mm-hmm. maybe harder,
mm-hmm.
was stricter with him.
Mm-hmm.
But also, what do you think having the lack maybe of a role model mm-hmm. did to him as a child?
You know, I think that made it harder for him because he had to figure out, you know, he had to figure out what it meant
to be a man.
To be a man. Yeah, and on his own, you know, without my dad there, because my dad wasn't there all the time. I mean, my mom has four brothers, and so they were there, but they weren't there. You know, they didn't live with us. They weren't the men in the household, and really my brother had to, you know, he had to assume that role for himself. And so he, you know, I think that earlier on he figured out that, you know, that what it meant to be a man was, you know, that it meant to provide, that, you know, that you had to provide and that you tried to do it, you know, you try to do it in any way that you possibly could, you know, mm-hmm. by whatever means you had, because you were one of the, you know, pillars of the family.
Yeah. What happened with your brother?
He was 19. He'd gotten a job at a local casino working in valet. He was a valet attendant. And so he took an extra shift. On his way home from work late that night on October the 2nd, he was driving home from work and he was hit by a drunk driver from behind. And the drunk driver was driving so fast that, my brother pressed on the brakes, but it didn't, do anything because he couldn't stop because he was hit from behind and he was hit. So, and the car was going so fast. And so he hit a tree, he hit a fire hydrant, the car flipped over, and he died. And then the man that hit him, lived actually and fled the scene of the accident. Eventually, after, say, a year, it might have been a little less than a year, the man went to trial for it. I mean, they didn't find him and the car that hit my brother. They didn't find both of them until the next day. And the man went to trial for it, and then he wasn't convicted in any way of killing my brother, of playing a role in his death. He was convicted of leaving the scene of an accident, and he was sentenced to 5 years in prison in order to pay, around, I think, $15,000 in restitution to my mom. And he never paid any of that, and then he went to jail for 3 years and 2 months, and then he has since been out.
And so, where were you when your brother died? The year was 2000.
I was living at home because I had graduated from Stanford and I could not find a job because I was an English major. So I couldn't find a job. And so I was living at home and I was attempting to find a job. And then because I'd gone so many months, I had been home for maybe 6 months and still couldn't find a job. And so I went to New York City to interview for different jobs. But I just went for a 4-day trip to interview, and I was supposed to come back. And so while I was gone on that 4-day trip, that's when my brother died. And so I came back and then I was home for around 3 more months. And then I realized that, it was impossible for me to find a job at home. So then I really did move to New York City.
Yeah. Tell me about the tattoo on your wrist.
I have two tattoos. I have one on each wrist. The first one that I got was on my left hand, or my left wrist, the inside of my left wrist. And it's my brother's, it's his signature. I got it off a card, a Mother's Day card that he gave to my mom. Probably because it's the clearest signature that we have of his still. And so I took it to the tattoo parlor and they put it on my left wrist. And then on my right wrist, it says, "Love, brother." And it's also in my brother's handwriting. And it's from a letter that he wrote me, the only letter that he wrote me while I was in college. And that's how he signed the letter. And so I got this one on my right wrist a few years after the one on my left.
Yeah. And you put it there for a very...
To protect myself pretty much from myself. my grief, it was very hard to live with my grief. And, once you sort of piled the grief on top of this, very sort of troubled, I guess, teenage, my troubled teenage years where I loathed myself, that meant that I was suicidal for a while. And so I thought, okay, if I do this, if I kill myself, I'll probably slit my wrists because, you always have access to a razor. And then I thought, well, I don't know if I can do that to my family, and what can I do so that I won't kill myself? And I thought, well, I can get a tattoo, and I can get a tattoo of his name across where I would make the cut, because of course I would make it with my right hand on my left wrist. And so I did. I went and I got that tattoo. And then a few years later, I was still feeling suicidal, still battling those feelings of depression and of worthlessness and hopelessness, really. And I thought, okay, I have to do something. Because now I'm thinking about using my left hand on my right wrist. And I thought, I'm going to get another tattoo, because I knew that if I had his handwriting on me, specifically on my wrist, that I would, if I got close to that moment where I thought that I could do something to myself, could try to attempt to kill myself, I thought I couldn't do it because I would see him. So that's why I did that.
We have only just about a minute left. You live back in the community where you where you came from. Mm-hmm. You have a daughter. You're mm-hmm. raising your child there. Mm-hmm. What has to change to raise this kind of oppression, of hopelessness, of all these factors that contribute in some way or another to the deaths of these young men?
I think that other people have to see us as human, and I think that then will make us see ourselves as human and not as worthless. And hopefully I think that would change things, you know, or that would begin to change things.
Do you see that happening?
The optimist in me hopes that it will happen, and it hopes that, you know, that in writing this book that I've taken, you know, that I've helped in some small way, hopefully, and you know, pushed us towards making that happen.
But is the community where you're from, mm-hmm. has it changed?
You know, I feel in some small ways, I feel like it's changed. You know, I feel like, you know, kids in my nephew's generation, and my nephew's 17. So kids in my nephew's generation, that they, I think that more of them see at least junior college as the next step, right? Whereas, you know, in my generation and the kids that I write about, a lot of them, they didn't, you know. But even though I say more of them see that as the next step, it's definitely not everybody. And I think that, you know, that in a lot of ways, my community, it hasn't changed.
Mm. That's Jesmyn Ward. We've been talking about her new book, a memoir. It is called Men We Reaped. And I want to thank you so much for being here and for sharing your story with us and with our listeners. Thank you, Jesmyn Ward, again. Her new book, Men We Reaped. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. And our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. I'm Maiken Scott, in for Marty Moskowain, and thank you so much for listening.